The Star Trek Writer's Guide begins with an exercise in believability, and the assertion that this, not monsters or aliens or technology, is key. It goes on to say, if you're one of those who answers, the character acts that way because it's science fiction, don't call us, we'll call you. He was a soldier, a pilot, a cop. He was the great bird of the galaxy, and that's where he's buried. Today on Sci-Fi Idols, let's talk about Gene Roddenberry, shall we? You know who Gene Roddenberry is. I don't have to tell you. You've watched one Star Trek series or another, possibly all of them. So I'm not going to talk about really who he was, but what he was. A lodestone, a magnet, to which icons of early television were attracted to, stuck to, and who, with a little metaphorical wire in motion, became the dynamo that catapulted television, sci-fi, and the fan convention into the modern social dictionary. The disputed date and subject for the first sci-fi convention is unimportant in this context. For fan conventions, though it's probably more accurate to call them meetings since it wasn't unusual to have only 20 or 30 attendees, began as early as 1936. But the modern con as we know it, a spectacle of costumes and merchandise and music and games and contests, most definitely traces its roots to Star Trek. In 1972, over 3,000 fans of an already canceled and well into syndication television show descended on the first Star Trek convention. Star Trek was in syndication on over 100 stations. Remember, this was well before cable TV, and in over 60 countries, and it only got bigger from there. Eugene Wesley Roddenberry, namesake of one Wesley Crusher, grew up in LA with brother Rob, sister Doris, mom Caroline, and father Eugene Edward Roddenberry. His dad was a cop, a profession he'd also take up after the war, having studied police science in college. There was always a lot of California in Gene, sun, diversity, freely available intellectual and artistic pursuits, and a sort of idealism that was unique to California for many years. Something that's hard to explain, but if you know what I mean, you know what I mean. This sort of living in the sunshine attitude would go on to color Gene's writing and his philosophies, and those of Star Trek. And this would mold a generation of fans into not only fans of the genre, but fans of the ideals that Star Trek came to represent. A better world for everyone, no matter who they are or where they come from. Gene was a pilot in the war, having developed an early interest in aviation and obtained a pilot's license in 1940. He joined the Army Air Corps in 1941 and went on to fly bombers in World War II, flying some 89 missions and earning the Distinguished Flying Cross and Air Medal. Before the war's end, he went on to become a crash investigator and Air Force troubleshooter. After the war, he flew commercial aircraft, most notably for Pan Am, and spent some time studying literature at Columbia. I may take some flack for saying this, but in a way he was everything Ron Hubbard claimed to be, except for the nuclear physicist part. But Gene didn't make it up, he actually did it all. The tale of his airliner's crash into the Syrian night desert is epic, for instance, and it's also well documented. Gene left the airline to pursue a career in the burgeoning TV industry, but didn't have immediate success. He joined the LAPD for a while and eventually did start selling scripts. Once he was well established, he left the force and began writing full time and soon found himself head writer on the crazy, crazy popular western Have Gun, Will Travel. You know, like in Stand By Me.
A soldier of fortune is the man called Halliday.
In 1963, his very own show, The Lieutenant, debuted and ran for just one season on NBC. But this was 1963, so we're talking 29 one-hour episodes, nothing to scoff at, especially in light of some of the 9 to 13 episode seasons we see today. And the onset of the war in Vietnam meant that military dramas was an electrified fence of sorts in 1963 for mainstream television. So this kind of spelled the death knell for the show. Its main character, one Lieutenant William Tiberius Rice, like that middle name, he was sent off to an unnamed Asian country at the end of the season. He would return much changed and some while later in the form of one James Tiberius Kirk. And there's another inadvertent Star Trek tie-in as well, but I'll get to that in a second. Oh, and for my Aussie friends, you might not realize it, but Gene also wrote a few episodes of the 1960s Aussie Western series Whiplash. Gene's next Western was to have a major plot twist. It was to take place in the future and in outer space. After doing two pilots, Star Trek premiered on NBC on September 8, 1966. The show ran for just three seasons, but some of you might not know that Gene wasn't very active in the last season. He was a bit stung by NBC's refusal to give the show, whose ratings were, to be fair, waning, a better time slot. But as we're all aware, Star Trek was not done, not by a long shot. Of all the television series that have ever run, even those that lasted longer than Star Trek's original three-year run, none has ever birthed so many successors. 12 films, one of which is in theaters right now, 5 live-action series, the original series, The Next Generation, debuting in 87, Deep Space Nine in 93, Voyager in 95, Enterprise in 2001, and one animated series, which ran two seasons from 73 to 74. One of the most infamous Star Trek episodes is Plato's Children, in which Kirk, a white guy, kisses Lieutenant Uhura, a black woman. At the time, bearing in mind this was just 3 years after the Selma riots and only months after the murder of Martin Luther King, this sort of thing was unheard of on TV, and many backwards, let's just say backwards, areas of the country were not crazy about this. Earlier that year, some execs had flipped the hell out just because Petula Clark touched Harry Belafonte on the arm. No, I'm not kidding. She touched his arm and some NBC execs freaked the F out, worrying that the hicks in Ricesville would have some sort of redneck heart attack. Well, Star Trek was ready to boldly go one better with James Tiberius Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura's kiss. But you may be surprised to find this was not the first such incident on one of Gene's shows, and not the first involving Nichelle Nichols. A 1964 episode of The Lieutenant, called To Set It Right, written by Lee Irwin, took on the endemic racism of the era head-on, and as a result, was never aired. Nichelle Nichols, Lieutenant Uhura in Star Trek, plays the wife of a soldier who is and has been racially antagonized by a fellow soldier. Such frank talk, including Captain Rambridge, Lieutenant White's superior, reminding him and the audience that this was not a problem that could be solved by a lieutenant in a few days, but something far larger, and the implication being that the country itself must deal with it. But of course, the country didn't get to see this powerful episode, but you can, including Dennis Hopper as the antagonist if you check out the Lieutenant DVD set. It's been said, but I can't confirm, that this incident is what drove Gene to want to infuse Star Trek with such intense social allegory that it would go on to become a symbol of equality and fairness to millions of fans. And considering that Nichols, now involved in two racially charged episodes, said that Gene was adamant that the kiss be shot and aired, it certainly seems plausible. Gene cared about these sorts of things. Being that California kid, he wanted to let the sun shine in and make the world a better place. He believed in equality for all. He believed in humanity pulling itself up out of the muck of racial and ethnic and religious conflict. And in Star Trek, he reflected that ideal world where these things have been left behind, where mankind has grown up and put away its childish things. No one starved in the Federation. People's skin color wasn't important. Everyone was given an education, and everyone made up their minds who and what they wanted to be, without the pressures of religion or race or social class to hold them back or derail them. This is encapsulated and distilled in the Vulcan idea of IDIC, infinite diversity and infinite combinations. After the original series, Gene didn't have a lot of success, but in 1975, There was an interest in relaunching Star Trek, and a return called Phase 2 was initiated. This didn't quite get off the ground, but it did eventually morph into the first Star Trek film, Star Trek The Motion Picture. And the rest I've already described. At any given hour around the world, it's a safe bet that Star Trek, in one incarnation or the other, is playing on television. Eclipsed only by the voluminous merchandising machine of Star Wars, the Star Trek franchise makes billions around the world each year in books, comics, DVDs, Blu-rays, and yes, television reruns of all the series, all the while sowing Gene's ideas of a better world, of equality and fairness to new generations. In 1991, on October 24th, Gene died. He was known to fans by an honorific that seemed to sum him up somehow, the Great Bird of the Galaxy. He left a lasting legacy of entertainment, sincerity, and justice that will not soon be forgotten. And his vision and ideals live on as a new generation discovers Star Trek, new and old, and carry the Great Bird's message into the future, perhaps one day to space. And there, somewhere, floats Eugene Wesley Roddenberry Sr.'s ashes, cast aloft into space by Space Shuttle Columbia in 1992. This was the second shuttle built by NASA, its predecessor being named Enterprise, in honor of the man himself, a man who exemplified what humanity wants to be, good, fair, just, and living in the sunshine of life. Gene Roddenberry, the great bird of the galaxy, and a true sci-fi icon. This has been Sci-Fi Idols with your host, Maggie McPhee. You can find us online at scifiidols.com. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod.